This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. You're usually expected to be pretty strong and stoic when you're a military spouse. But in the new memoir, No Man's War, Irreverent Confessions of an Infantry Wife, Angela Ricketts writes about the difficulties she faced during her husband's 8 deployments. These included the stresses it put on their marriage and on raising their 3 children, and the toll of always bracing herself for the next goodbye. She also writes about the culture at home on the military bases, the responsibilities of being an officer's wife, and the relationships she formed with other infantry wives. Her husband was deployed 8 times, 4 of those times to Iraq or Afghanistan. He was a lieutenant during his first deployment to Somalia in 1992. Later in his military career, he was promoted to battalion commander. He's now a colonel in Homeland Defense, Northern Command. They live in Colorado Springs. Angela Ricketts has a master's degree in social psychology and human relations. Last Tuesday, Terry asked Ricketts what she thought was a simple question. During the 22 years they've been married, how much time was Ricketts' husband away from home during his deployments?
Just asking me the amount of time he's been deployed and the amount of deployments is such a hot button in our culture, because what some people call deployments and what other people call deployments are always not the same thing. There's a new school of thought that takes everything before 9/11 and says that was not a deployment. He went to Somalia right after we got married, and that's actually where he got his combat patch. And I measured every deployment after that against Somalia, because that was really intense and really scary. And we didn't have the technology that we do now with emails and immediate news. I had, you know, Christiana Monpour, who I just hung on her every word on CNN back then. That was all I knew. And the few letters that I got from him. So to me, that was truly a deployment. But after that, he went to Macedonia, he went to Bosnia, he went to Kosovo, and those were each 6 months. And then he did 2 about a half a year deployments in Afghanistan, then a 15-month deployment to Iraq, and then a year in Afghanistan. So I would say 6 years.
6 out of about 22?
Yeah, deployed.
So did you think of Army wife as a profession?
I did, actually, because my mother, I come from an Army family, and we are a culture that does lend itself to perpetuating Army brats who either become Army spouses or soldiers themselves. So as much as when I was a teenager, I wanted to be rebellious and I wanted to do something different, as I got into college and saw other things and saw what life outside the little Army bubble was like, the more I realized that I really wanted to, I enjoyed Army life and wanted to be an Army wife.
And why did you want to be an Army wife as opposed to enlisting in the military?
Well, it's funny that you asked that, because I actually, I got a wild hair and went and talked to a recruiter once. It was between my sophomore and junior year at Indiana University, and I had bad grades and I just was fed up. And I went and talked to a recruiter, and the recruiter called my parents' house, and my dad answered the phone and said, "She did what? Did she sign anything?" And slammed the phone down. And he came and talked to me and said, "Listen, if you think that you want to be a soldier, let's do this. I can get you into an ROTC program and you can see what it's like. And you don't have to sign anything. There's no commitment, and you can just try it out." So a week later, I found myself in the ROTC's version of basic training at Fort Knox. It was a 6-week school training with actual real drill sergeants and real barracks and real awfulness. I felt like it was a sitcom, but it was very real. And I very quickly realized that that end of soldiering was not at all for me.
Why wasn't it for you?
Maybe it was the rules and the structure, and I wanted to know why. Every time they told me to do something, I just really wanted to say, "That's really stupid. Why? Who cares if there's water droplets in the water fountain?" That was my job in the barracks, was to make sure there were no water droplets in the fountain. the drinking fountain. And I thought that was really dumb. So I think that when you're a soldier, you definitely fit this sort of mold where you can take orders and you don't need to know why. You just do what you're told.
Okay, and so you couldn't do that, but you married somebody who could. So
I married my polar opposite, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's the division right there. You mm-hmm. found the person who could follow the rules that you couldn't follow.
Absolutely. When I met him, he was hyper-organized. He was vigilant about his routines and his rituals and the way his structure and following orders and doing everything the right way the first time. And I was just really kind of flying by the seat of my pants all the time, and I still am. That's my nature. So we've always been very attracted to that quality that the other one doesn't have.
But that has also caused friction.
Yes, it definitely has caused friction.
And friction including in parenting. And I think parenting must be such a difficult issue for couples in the military, you know, where one is deployed and one is home, because the spouse who's deployed is away so much of the time during the formative years of the children's lives. And that was the case with you, right? I mean, you managed
yes.
to, like, give birth in between deployments. You planned it
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
But then your husband would leave, and you raised, you know, during many of the years when you raised your three children, you were virtually a single mother at home.
Right, right. And that was tough. And when the kids were babies, I would remind myself that they wouldn't remember those deployments, so it wasn't really kind of fundamentally changing them and how they grew up. But as they got older, this last deployment, our oldest son, Jack, was, his name is Joe in the book, he was in sixth grade. So he was just getting to the point where he really missed his dad, and he was angry that his dad was gone, because he knew that his dad had volunteered for that last year in Afghanistan and that he didn't have to go. So that was, you know, it's a really weird mix of pride and also some anger, too.
A feeling of rejection? Or of second placeness?
Second placeness, yes. Yes, definitely a feeling of being the second priority. And we knew we weren't. And we discussed it as a couple about him going back. But we also knew that there was a price to pay with how much he would miss with our kids. Most of the Army couples that I'm familiar with, most of our close friends, the mom is the disciplinarian. So when the dad is back from the deployments, he's like, oh, let's just break all the rules. Let's just eat chips on the couch and do all these crazy things. And that's me. I'm the dad's gone, let's eat chips on the couch. So when he's deployed, I just kind of have this attitude of, listen, guys, get good grades, be respectful, and the world is your oyster. You can do whatever you want. You can watch TV, you can play outside, you know, just meet these basic requirements and the rest of it is up to you. So when Darren's back, there's a lot more. Each day is structured. For example, the other day when your producer called and I talked to him, he said something like, where's your husband and your kids right now? And I laughed to myself because they were on a 4.5-hour death march around Lake Michigan.
Not a hike, death march.
Yes, that's what we call it. We don't call it a hike. We call it a death march. So he really is very, very good at maximizing every second that he's there. He's very, very present with our kids, and he is a wonderful, wonderful father. He definitely does want everything done. He thinks his way is the best way, but he's gotten a lot better at allowing everybody to kind of be themselves a little bit more than he did in the early years.
But I could see this leading to a lot of friction in parenting styles during the periods when he was home. And I'm sure that maybe that's true of a lot of military couples when the spouse who's been deployed is home, that there's a clash of parenting styles because you haven't had time to develop a co-parenting approach.
That's true. Luckily, one of the great things, our kids never realized that. Our kids never figured that out and used that against us. As I heard you say that, I started thinking about that. they totally could have played us against each other, and they never did that. But he would get back, and he would be a little resentful that I hadn't, you know, held everybody to the standards that he would have with all of the sports involvements. All of our kids are athletes. But a couple of the times in the big, long deployments, their athletics took a backseat because I was just too overwhelmed. I couldn't get everybody to all of their practices and do all of the things that I needed to do to support his job and take care of everything else. So their athletics took a backseat at certain points, and he would be resentful of that. And then I, in turn, would be resentful that he was resentful because I would be like, listen, buddy, when you are gone, there's a price to pay. And the price to pay is that you can't control everything and you can't dictate to me how I'm going to get through this. As long as we're all alive and standing upright and breathing in and out when you get back, then my job is done.
One of the things you write about is the emotional difficulty of saying goodbye when it's time for your husband to start a new deployment. And you use the expression black soul. Would you describe what that means?
The black soul is the numbness that sort of you reach a point after, the first few deployments, it just rips your gut out when you say goodbye. And you're just left in this puddle of just tears and emotion and just weepy for days. And that can only happen so many times, just like they say you can really only have your heart broken once. Well, after the first really wretched, wretched deployment, each one after that, you become a little more stoic, a little more removed, a little more numb to the feelings. And that kind of blackens your soul. We joke about that. Army wives say, channel the black soul, honey. It's time to channel your black soul.
And when your husband was home in between deployments, was the black soul there then too? Could you allow yourself to really feel, because you knew he'd be leaving again? It was just a question of time.
Right. Yeah, no, the black soul was always there. The black soul showed up, I think I say in the book, and it's true, around 2006. But yeah, when he was home, we were very careful to maintain a level of distance with each other. There was never, you know, that kind of, we couldn't finish each other's sentences. There were a lot of moments that we'd miss, the funny jokes, the funny stories. I shared a lot of those with other Army wives. I didn't share those stories with him. So when he would come home, there was so much that we each had to tell each other that we didn't know where to start, and we just didn't tell each other very much. We would just sort of try to pick up where we had left off. And that left us with not a whole lot to talk about a lot of the time. So now, having him not deployed, it's kind of fun to finally be able to complete each other's sentences and have a little more just peace between us for the first time. There's definite peace there that never was before.
Did you think the marriage was going to break up?
Yes, I did. In 2008, I thought that was it. And I think he thought that was it too. When he came home from 15 months in Iraq, he came home right before Halloween, and November was very hard, and when we got the Christmas decorations out, I remember him, I didn't write about this in the book, and we've never talked about it since, but I remember him pulling the Christmas decorations out, and he looked at me, and he kind of was a little teary, and he said, this might be the last time that we do this. And I just nodded, and I thought that maybe it was. So I was really happy that we made it through that. There are a lot of couples that give up at that point, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's no, you know, we almost did, and it's by the grace of God that we didn't. But it changes you. Each deployment changes you a little more. It takes a little bit of who you are, but it adds something else. I mean, I don't mean to make it all sound so negative, because there were so many beautiful things that happened to both of us, but it did nearly break us, but it didn't.
In May of 2006, there was a Chinook helicopter crash in remote mountains of Afghanistan. And Army protocol is that there's a communications blackout on the home front for the families until the families are directly notified. They don't want you to find out about it on the news or from anybody else. But once the news is announced about the crash, you write about how everybody just is obsessed with CNN. and wants to get whatever updates they can. Would you describe what life was like where you were after that crash was announced on the news and what all the wives were worried about? Like, did you know if the battalion that your husbands were in, the men from that battalion could have been on that helicopter?
Well, that was the spring of 2006, like you said, and most everyone was in Iraq. That was the national focus back then, was Iraq, 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 and Afghanistan felt like it was almost won. So we didn't have that many soldiers in Afghanistan at the time. And when we heard about that crash, we knew that there were only a handful of brigades over there. So there were, it was a very high likelihood that that crash was us. And I knew that it wasn't Darren. As much as I knew that it wasn't Darren, I...
Why did you know it wasn't your husband?
Well, because he was on the division staff at the time, and he wasn't necessarily flying around in helicopters doing combat operations in the job that he was in. So I was fairly confident that he was sitting in an office back from where that happened. But I wasn't sure. I hadn't talked to him since Tuesday, and that the crash was on a Friday. And it was Saturday when we saw the ticker tape go around CNN. So it was a really long day. It was a beautiful, perfectly clear spring summer day. I went to the commissary to get groceries. That place was almost empty, and normally it would have been really crowded. There would have been tons of kids on the playgrounds. There was no one on the playground. It was like everyone was just staying in their house, staying away from each other. And looking back, I don't know if that's maybe because when they say commo blackout...
The communications blackout?
Yes, the communications blackout. There are exceptions to that rule. And when it takes a really long time to do the next of kin notifications of a casualty, the more people are going to find out through, you know, other channels, and the higher likelihood of the spouses. The worst case scenario is that the spouse of a killed soldier finds out through an unauthorized channel, so like from a neighbor or something horrible like that. And that's, I'm sure that's probably happened. So that's why we have such strict protocol.
Well, you actually did find out one of the casualties from your husband. Would you explain what happened?
Well, what happened was Darren was on the division staff, and when the Chinook went down, there was a battalion commander of a cavalry squadron, which was the kind of battalion that my husband was going to take command of. But he was on the Chinook, and he had not manifested. That means he wasn't on the roster.
This is the battalion commander you're talking about?
Yes, uh-huh. He jumped on it at the last minute. And there were a lot of people who saw him get on, but he was not on the official roster. So that's one of the things that slowed down the casualty notification process that day. But Darren was told initially in the you know, few chaotic moments after this Chinook crashed that he was very probably going to take command of that battalion with this vacancy because the commander had just been killed, and that he needed to call me and let me know that this was happening because he was supposed to come home in 3 weeks. And if he had taken that command, it would have meant staying in Afghanistan for another year. So he came to call me, and I was with my very close friend, who was the close friend of the woman whose husband had been killed. She was exhausted from her phone ringing, and I had not heard from Darren, so she came to my house, and we were having pizza when my phone rang, and it was Darren, and it was a very broken connection. I couldn't hear him. I could hear his voice. And so my friend was cutting pizza for our kids, and I kind of slithered down the hallway to cloister into my daughter's bedroom, and I closed the door so that I could hear him, what he was trying to tell me. And he told me that he was likely going to stay in Afghanistan, and he asked what we'd heard back at Fort Drum. And I said we hadn't heard anything, that it was complete silence. And he told me who'd been killed, and he said that he was ordered to call and tell me because he was likely going to stay there. And when he told me who it was, I said, my God, her best friend is in the kitchen cutting pizza. And he said, I wish you'd told me that before we started this conversation. And I was like, sorry I didn't give you a roll call of who was at my house when you called, but He told me that the wife of the killed battalion commander still didn't know and that they were likely going to notify her the next morning, so I had to keep it to myself until then.
How hard was that to do?
Well, and I promised him that I would, and I hung up the phone with him, and I was just shaking, and I kind of tried to gather myself, and I thought, well, I can't tell her that this has happened. I'm just going to have to go out there and just, you know, say, oh, yeah, it was a crash, but both of our husbands are okay, and let's watch a movie, and let's open a bottle of wine. I opened the door to the bedroom to go out, and she was leaning against the wall, and she just had this terrible, stricken look on her face that I will never, ever forget. And she'd heard me whisper, and she'd heard that, oh, my gosh, she's here. I can't, you know, she thought that it was her husband who'd been killed. So when I opened that door, she thought that I was going to tell her that her husband was killed. And she just kind of slid down the wall and said, that was my husband, wasn't it, who was killed. And I said, no, it wasn't yours. It was, and I said the name of the close friend. I mean, honest, literally within 30 seconds, I spit it all right out there. And we just laid there together, and it was terrible. It was very, very terrible. This was a wonderful couple. He was a very, very respected leader, very smart. They'd been married for almost, I want to say close to 20 years and had never had children. And she just had their first baby. They had a baby who was, I think she was about a month old. So she never met her dad. It was kind of the worst of, you know, of all of the case scenarios for us at that time.
Well, Angie, I know we've interrupted your vacation. I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This was an incredible opportunity. I appreciate it.
Angela Ricketts speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Ricketts's new memoir is called No Man's War, Irreverent Confessions of a Military Wife. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.
I'm Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times. Since 1976,
Roger Ebert was perhaps the most famous film critic of his generation. Now there's a new documentary about his life and death called Life Itself. Our next guest is Steve James, the director of the film, who also directed Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters. And also with us is Chaz Ebert, who was married to Roger for 21 years. Roger Ebert reviewed movies for the Chicago Sun-Times for 46 years and appeared on TV reviewing movies for 31 years. Initially, his TV co-host and sparring partner was also his local newspaper rival, Gene Siskel, film critic for the Chicago Tribune. They became known for giving movies a thumbs up or thumbs down. Roger Ebert was diagnosed with cancer in 2002. 4 years later, cancer of the thyroid and salivary gland led to surgery that removed part of his lower jaw. It left him permanently unable to eat, drink, or speak. But his popularity seemed to only increase as he became famous for blogging and tweeting about film. Just after director Steve James started planning to shoot his documentary on Ebert, Ebert's cancer returned and he was hospitalized. He died 4 months later. But during those final months, he allowed James to film him in the hospital. Terry spoke with Steve James and Chaz Ebert earlier this month, and they began with an archival clip that's included in Life Itself, featuring Ebert and Siskel on their TV show in 1987, arguing about the children's movie Benji the Hunted. Midway through the clip, we hear a comment from New York Times film critic A.O. Scott.
Benji the Hunted exhausted me. This is the first time I wanted to tell a dog to slow down and stop to smell the flowers.
I don't know, Gene. Your review is the typical sort of blasé, sophisticated, cynical review.
I'll take the word sophisticated.
I would expect from an adult.
Well, you're wrapping yourself in the flag of children, and I'm saying
yourself in the flag of the sophisticated film
no,
critic
boredom.
Who's seen it all.
No, boredom. Boredom with
I
Benji running.
I don't think that any child is going to be bored by this
it
movie.
It was not, you know, gentlemanly. It was not, well, I see you have a good point. It was, I'm going to crush you.
And this is the show where you give Benji the Hunted a positive review and not Kubrick's
Now, Gene,
film.
That's totally unfair because you realize that these reviews are relative. Benji the Hunted is not one-tenth
Roger.
The film that the Kubrick film is, but you know that you review films within context. And you know it, and you should be ashamed of yourself.
No, I'm not.
Now let's take another look at the movie.
Wow. And that's a clip of Life Itself. That was an excerpt of Ebert and Siskel together. And Steve James, Chaz Ebert, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on this film. And Chaz, I'm just so sorry that Roger Ebert isn't with us anymore.
Thank you. Yes. He would enjoy Steve's film about him.
I think so. Steve, you expected to make a movie about Roger Ebert, a living person, but he went back into the hospital shortly after you started to meet about making the movie, and he died 4 months later. So the movie ends up being about his death as well as his life. And I'm wondering how your whole idea of what this movie was going to be changed when you found out that his cancer had come back and the things weren't looking good.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. When we started, I had this idea, and really I took the idea from his memoir, because I think one of the beautiful things about Roger's memoir is that he's writing about his life from the vantage point of where he is in his life now when he wrote it, which is, he's been through all these cancers, he's lost his ability to speak and eat, and he's looking back on this incredible life he's had and conjuring up the memories of it. And I loved the way that was done in the memoir, and so I wanted to do a similar thing in the film. And so I wanted to follow his life with Chaz, going to screenings. They would throw dinner parties. And even though Roger could no longer speak at those parties, he still sat at the head of the table and sort of presided over them. And I wanted to basically show that here's a guy who has been through hell, and yet he has not let it slow him down. He's writing more than ever. He's going to screenings. He's going to festivals. He's living his life. And then I wanted to use that life in the present as a springboard to the past. And in a sense, that is what the film is that we made, but with one important difference, that weren't able to capture all those things in the present that I wanted. We ended up capturing in the present Roger struggling with first a fractured hip that then turns out to be cancer, and all of the complications from that that eventually lead to his passing.
Chaz, by the time the film got rolling, he was physically compromised because of the surgery.
Yes.
And because of what happened
yes.
to his jaw. And I think when you
yes.
love someone and they're physically compromised, and when they've been in and out of the hospital, your impulse is to protect them. But in a documentary film, what happens is that you expose them. and so I'm wondering if you had these conflicting feelings during the documentary of wanting to kind of just protect him from any kind of, you know, scrutiny or anything, but also wanting to, you know, put him in the spot, you know, help him be in the spotlight, knowing that would also expose things that were maybe unflattering as well as things that were flattering.
Yes, that's a fair question. And of course, I wanted to protect him, but Roger was fearless. And so as his partner in life, you know, if he wanted to be transparent, it was not up to me to say, no, don't do this. There is one part of the movie that was difficult for me, the part where they're doing a medical procedure, clearing his airways. And that is not anything I wanted on camera, because I know how involved it is. I know how difficult it is to watch. You know, I know that it's something that audiences would turn away from. Roger, though, knew it was important, because it's something that happened several times a day in his life that was part of his new normal. And so he arranged with Steve to come over and shoot that when I was out of town, because he knew that I wouldn't want that shown on film.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yes.
I had watched Roger Ebert on television for years, starting when their show was first carried on PBS, and then through the years when it was syndicated. And so, yes. And so I feel like, you know, I watched him get older on TV. And then I was, like so many of the people who followed him, I was stunned after the jaw surgery to see how his face was transfigured by the yes. surgery, and, you know, how unusual his jaw looked afterwards.
Yes.
And it was just, you know, it like, you want, in a way you wanted to turn away, and when you wanted to look, and it was just so strange to see somebody whose face was so familiar transformed like that. And I was wondering how that would be dealt with in the movie, and how it's dealt with is like, you want to know about this, I'm going to show you early on, and the camera is nearly inside Roger's mouth. during one shot. And then it kind of pulls back, and then soon we see this suctioning that you described, in which I'm not sure of exactly why it's done or what it's done, but he has the equivalent of like a tracheostomy in his neck and a tube.
Yes, and it keeps that was to clear his airways, to keep any accumulations from going into his lungs.
And he looks uncomfortable when they do it. I don't mean uncomfortable that he's on camera. I mean, it looks very physically uncomfortable. You see him wincing. But Steve, so I'm going to ask you here how you felt about filming almost like inside his throat and then pulling back and showing this procedure, which Chaz was wishing that you hadn't even shown. And just like knowing that people were kind of like probably strangely curious about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I had, you know, of course, met with Chaz and Roger before we began filming, and the first time I met with them, it was the first time I'd ever seen Roger not in the public Roger way of where he would go out, and he would wear a black turtleneck. And, you know, when I would see him out publicly, I just thought he was quite stylish. When I met with them privately, I realized because he was wearing the white bandage, not the black turtleneck, is that was also, of course, quite functional, is it prevented you from clearly seeing through his jaw to his neck. But even in the meetings, I was sort of struck by it. But when I went in that very first day to film, and Chaz wasn't there, Roger was asleep. And it's the first image that we show of him in the present in the film. He was asleep. And there's something about anyone who's asleep, you're very vulnerable. And in his case, there was that vulnerability of being asleep, but it was also his jaw then, because of that, hung way, way down. And I remember very distinctly thinking, oh my God, what are we going to do about this? In a way, I knew that people would watch this movie if we film it the way it is and have the same reaction I was having right there and then. So then what happened was, he woke up, and you see this moment in the film. He wakes up, and he looks up at me, because I happened to be shooting this myself then. He looks up at me, and he smiles. Suddenly, he was Roger, the Roger I knew. I was relieved and encouraged by that. And so then when we filmed the suction, which I did know that Chaz didn't want, and when I filmed it, I realized fully why. I mean, it was very unsettling, and I felt intrusive. And I think what happened is that Roger saw that look on my face when it was over, when, you know, I put the camera down, and I think he saw that I was feeling guilty about having filmed it, which is, I think, why he sent me this email that I got when I got home, and we included in the film where the email, the title of it was, "Great stuff!" exclamation, exclamation, exclamation. And then the body of it is, he says something like, you know, "I'm so glad we got something today nobody sees. Suction. Cheers, Roger." I can't tell you what a relief it was to me to read that email. I mean, it exonerated me in a way, but I think what it really was saying is that for all of Roger's courageous public embracing of what he'd gone through, that he was ready for a different level of candor in this film that the public had not seen and that he felt was important. And he knew that I thought it was important too. And I think going forward, my hope is that if we can very quickly early on in the film sort of show you what it is and not hold it back, that my hope is that as the movie progresses, that you will become acclimated enough to the reality of his life so that you're seeing past it and seeing Roger and not seeing the hole in his jaw.
Roger Ebert became famous nationally with his rival film critic in Chicago, Gene Siskel, through the program that they did that I think started in Chicago, then became national on public television, and then became syndicated, and it went through various incarnations, but it became quite famous. And we knew watching the show that they were rival critics. Roger worked at the Chicago Sun-Times and Siskel at the rival paper, the Chicago Tribune. And, you know, watching the show and watching them quarrel, you never really knew how much of the rivalry was for real and how much of it was for the show. So just to give a sense of how deep the rivalry really went, this is a really fabulous outtake that's in the documentary Life Itself. This is a promo they were recording for the next show, and you'll hear them quarreling and doing like take after take after take. And so here's Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel.
Two thrillers this week on Siskel and Ebert. First, we'll review Michael Caine and Pierce Brosnan in The Fourth Protocol. And then Gene Hackman and Kevin Costner star in No Way Out. And we have a third thriller, too, if you're interested. What do you mean, two thrillers? How about something like this? It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert, and we've got three big ones. Okay. Ready?
I guess you're going
to
do it.
You have to rewrite it, don't we? Because you can't.
Oh, no, let's...
You can't ad-lib, Gene.
Can we do for the last week, and next week we'll do it?
No, every week counts.
You read it, then. You ad-lib it. I'll do nothing. Let him do whatever he wants. It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert in the movies, and we've got three new ones.
Gotta have energy up and the movies out.
Why don't you read both parts?
I'd like to.
I know that.
Please get your energy up.
It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert in the movies, and we've got three new ones.
Dennis Quaid in The Big Easy, Michael Caine in The Fourth Protocol, and Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman in No Way Out. Sound a little excited, Gene.
Sound less excited, Roger. That's why we're redoing it, because of what you did. It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert at the movies, and we've got three new ones.
And the movies, not at the movies. And that's why we're doing it this time.
It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert in the movies, and we've got three new ones.
Dennis Quaid in The Big Easy, Michael Caine in The Fourth Protocol, and Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman in No Way Out.
That's this week on Siskel and Ebert and the movies and the asshole.
Wow, I know, ouch. So, Steve James, from what you learned making this film, were Ebert and Siskel as competitive most of the time as they sound in this?
Yes, and maybe even more. I mean, that was the thing that was amazing to me about it, which is that, you know, when I watched the show, I didn't have any doubt that these guys were legitimately debating and arguing and didn't have a lot of love for each other at times. And it was really important, I think, in the movie to really try to trace that relationship, because I think that relationship with Gene, outside of Roger's relationship to Chaz, was the most important one of his life. And they were, you know, as been said, like bickering brothers and such. But the thing you had to remember is, you know, I bickered with my brother when I was 17 and 18. These guys were in their 40s and 50s and they were going at it.
Chaz, did Roger Ebert take that kind of tension home with him? I mean, did the friction in his relationship with Gene Siskel, did he carry that around with him?
He did. They used to tape the show on Wednesdays. And in the beginning, I would go to the studio to watch them tape the show, but it was too brutal for me to even watch. I started avoiding the studio on tape days because I saw that dynamic between them, and I didn't think it was that healthy for Roger, quite frankly. And he would come home on day. Well, I could tell if it was a good day or a bad day at the studio by the way he looked when he came home, and if he felt that, oh, I really bested Gene on all the reviews, he would come home kind of in a soaring manner, and it would be a good time. But sometimes he came home and he was still angry, you know, with Gene, thinking, what's wrong with him? Why did he do that? You know, and I would say, Roger, come on, let's do something. Let's do some meditation or something. Leave it at the studio. So I did see it mellowed over the years as they became friendlier with each other. They still remained competitive, but it wasn't as vitriolic.
Did you watch the show, Chaz, before you were married to Roger, before you knew him?
You know, the show started in Chicago. Everyone in Chicago watched the show. And yes, I did watch the show, and I liked it. I thought it was great.
Who did you prefer, Ebert or Siskel?
If I have to be, do I have to tell you the truth?
Yeah, I think so.
In the beginning, I preferred Siskel. Yeah, it's true. I didn't, all these years, I didn't want to say it, but it's true. I something about Gene on that show was something that I could relate to. Once I met Roger in person, however, Case Closed. Roger was my favorite because I saw how funny he was, how genuine he was, how he was so curious about other people, and I just fell in love with him. And there was no way that I could watch the show after that without seeing how superior Roger was to Gene.
Did their rivalry carry over to you and Gene Siskel's wife?
No. One thing, the boys knew that, and that's what we used to call them. We call them the boys. No, they knew that with the wives, you know, they had to be on good behavior. When the four of us were together, it was actually fun. They could relax into being social with each other and laugh at what was going on. So, no, that kind of rivalry, there was no place for it when we were all together.
Gene Siskel died of brain cancer in 1999 at the age of 53. And apparently, you know, I learned this from your movie, he didn't really tell people about it. And one of the people he didn't tell was Roger. And so when did Roger Ebert actually find out?
Roger was wounded by that. You know, when the last time we saw Gene in person was on the set of the show, and we actually gave him a ride home after they taped the last show, and they had put out a press release that Gene was going on hiatus to take a little time to deal with the aftermath of his surgeries, and that he'd be back in the fall to resume the show, or back later in the season to resume the show. And that's what we thought. And Roger, we were telling Gene, Roger said, I think that's a good idea. You know, go and, you know, have a good time with your family, travel, do whatever you want to do while you're taking some time off. And, you know, Gene used to call Roger Big Guy. And so Roger just jokingly said to him, and Big Guy, we'll see you later when we come back to do the show again. Well, someone knew that Roger really didn't know that Gene was dying, and I can't disclose who did it, but someone got a message to us that they thought we should know that Gene was dying, that he was never coming back to the show. And we were astounded. I said, let's go visit Gene. Let's go and tell him goodbye. And we were going to go. We had made plans to go to the hospital that Monday, but to the hospice. But Gene passed away that Saturday.
So,
and that's what caused Roger to want to be more open. He said, if anything like this ever happens to me, I want you to let people know who mean something to us. You know, I don't think he meant that it would be public, but just people who we knew who were close friends or family, people we loved or cared about.
Steve, do you feel like you were changed by making this movie, by getting so close to Roger Ebert at the end of his life?
Absolutely. I feel really changed. I feel like this movie, in a lot of ways, you know, it's a love story on all these levels. It's clearly one with Chaz. It's one with movies and with life. And the way in which he lived his life and embraced it was moving. The way in which he stared down death and lived it through the end was something extraordinary. And it is something that you think about, you can't help but think about, like when you get to that place. I mean, at the end of this movie, he is comforting Chaz. He is saying, you must let me go. I've had a wonderful life. I don't know how many people facing that end could do that. It's a remarkable thing. And so for me, you know, this movie is really, it's very much a movie about how to live your life with great exuberance and passion and humanity, and it's also how to die.
Chaz, has that affected your feeling about the, you know, future inevitability of your own death?
It has. It has made me absolutely unafraid of death. I think one of the gifts of this movie that I hope that people take away from it is that we all say it, that death is a part of life, but I don't know if we really believe it because we're so afraid of death. And the way that I, you know, one of the gifts that he gave me personally in being there with him when he transitioned is it was so beautiful. I never expected it to be that beautiful. And I think I used the word serene because the atmosphere in the room was just lovely. It was just lovely. And I never, ever wanted to see anyone die. And to be there with Roger when he transitioned like that and to see how effortlessly he did it, and while we were holding his hands, and the feeling in the room was one of love and peace and serenity. I mean, it was just a gift.
I regret that we're out of time. I want to thank you both so much. Chaz Ebert, thank you so much for being here. Steve James, thank you, and congratulations on the film. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Steve James and Chaz Ebert spoke with Terry earlier this month. James directed the new documentary about Roger Ebert called Life Itself. Chaz Ebert was married to Roger for 21 years and is the president of Ebert Productions and publisher of Ebert Digital. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Charlie Kyer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.